A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
The oldest surviving human-made marks aren't carvings. They're hand stencils and animal paintings on cave walls, some over 40,000 years old. The paint, in some cases, outlasted the stone it was applied to, which raises a question that feels increasingly urgent as we push digital storage to its limits. What did those ancient painters figure out that we're now scrambling to relearn?
That's the thing. Engineers developing archival media are literally looking at 40,000-year-old paint chemistry right now. The M-disc, which we'll get to, is a direct descendant of ochre on limestone.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about permanence. We've talked industrial markers, pigment science, the whole etting lineup. But he's pointing at the deeper question. When archaeologists find the remnants of early civilizations, they find two things: carvings and paintings. Those are the original accelerated aging tests. And the prompt is basically, what can we learn from how ancient civilizations daubed and etched? Has carving always weathered time better? Or do we have paintings that actually beat the chisel?
The answer is genuinely surprising. Paintings can win. Under the right conditions, a smear of red ochre on a cave wall will outlast a carved inscription exposed to rain and freeze, thaw cycles by tens of thousands of years.
Which is not what you'd expect. If you gave most people a choice between carving something into rock and painting it on, they'd bet on the carving every time.
And they'd be wrong often enough that it's worth understanding why. So when we talk about permanent marking, we're really talking about two different problems: marking something that lasts a decade and marking something that lasts 10 millennia. Let's start by understanding what ancient civilizations figured out.
The first thing to get straight is the timescale. When a factory floor manager says permanent, they mean legible through 10 years of chemical spills and forklift traffic. When an archaeologist says permanent, they mean surviving 40,000 years of whatever the planet throws at it. These are different engineering problems.
And ancient people solved them with two fundamental approaches: subtractive, which is carving or etching into a substrate, and additive, which is applying pigment to a surface. Both have examples that survived into the present, but they survived under very different conditions.
That distinction, subtractive versus additive, turns out to be the skeleton key for understanding the whole permanence problem.
It really does. And here's the wild part. In 2009, a company called Millenniata, later acquired by Verbatim, launched a write-once optical disc called the M-disc. The recording layer is a synthetic rock-like material. The laser physically etches pits into it, like a digital petroglyph. The inspiration came directly from studying how ancient marks survived. Doug Hansen, the founder, has said the concept clicked when he looked at petroglyphs and realized the most permanent marks physically alter a stable substrate rather than applying a reactive coating.
The M-disc is essentially a cave painting you can read with a Blu-ray drive.
A cave painting with a 1,000-year projected lifespan. But let's back up and understand why ancient techniques worked, because the material science is elegant.
To understand why some marks last and others don't, we need to look at the two fundamental approaches: carving and painting. Let's start with carving, because it's the most intuitive.
Carving is subtractive. You remove material from a substrate to create a physical depression. That depression is inherently protected from a lot of degradation mechanisms. UV light hits the surface, but the carved text sits below the surface plane. Wind-blown abrasives skip over the depression. The mark is a shape, not a coating, so there's nothing to peel or flake.
The Rosetta Stone is the textbook example. Carved in 196 BCE, the text was incised into granodiorite, a hard igneous rock. The inscription survived because it's a physical depression in a chemically stable substrate. There's no pigment to fade, no binder to decay. The mark is the absence of material.
Granodiorite is a great choice, whether they knew it or not. It's composed mostly of quartz and feldspar, both highly resistant to chemical weathering. Quartz is silicon dioxide, essentially inert at Earth's surface conditions. It doesn't dissolve in rainwater. It doesn't oxidize. It just sits there being quartz.
The Behistun inscription in Iran from 515 BCE is another one. Darius I had it carved into a cliff face about 100 meters up. It's a massive trilingual inscription, essentially the Persian Empire's version of a billboard, announcing, "I rule this place." And it survived 2,500 years of open-air exposure.
That cliff face was chosen carefully, even if the choice was intuitive rather than scientific. The inscription is on a near-vertical surface that sheds water quickly. Water doesn't pool, doesn't seep into cracks, doesn't freeze and expand. Freeze-thaw spalling is one of the biggest killers of carved stone. Water gets into microfractures, freezes, expands by about 9%, and wedges the rock apart from the inside. Over enough cycles, the surface literally flakes off in sheets.
That's where environment becomes the dominant variable. A carving in a dry, stable environment will outlast a carving in a place with freeze-thaw cycling by orders of magnitude. The technique matters, but the environment matters more.
The Nazca lines are a fascinating edge case here. They're geoglyphs created between about 500 BCE and 500 CE in the Peruvian desert. The technique was subtractive. The Nazca people removed the dark desert pavement stones, coated in a patina of iron and manganese oxides baked by the sun over millennia to reveal the lighter subsoil underneath. So the mark is a color contrast created by subtraction.
They survived because the Nazca Desert gets almost no rain. We're talking less than an inch per year. No water, no freeze-thaw, and the wind is consistent enough that it doesn't scour the surface unpredictably. The lines have been sitting there, essentially unchanged, for over 1,000 years.
About 1,500 to 2,000 years, depending on which geoglyph you're dating. The dark pavement stones are a natural varnish. By removing them, the Nazca people created a negative image. There's no applied pigment to degrade. The contrast is between two native materials that are both stable in that environment. It's subtractive marking at landscape scale.
But here's the counterintuitive finding that the prompt is pointing at. Some cave paintings are better preserved than Roman stone inscriptions that are a fraction of their age.
This is where it gets really interesting. The Chauvet cave paintings in France are about 32,000 years old. They were discovered in 1994, and they're so well preserved that you can see individual brush strokes. The charcoal lines are crisp. The shading is visible. These are not faint ghost images you need special lighting to see. They're vivid.
Because a rockfall sealed the cave entrance about 20,000 years ago, the interior became a time capsule. Stable temperature. Stable humidity, no UV, no wind, no microbial activity because there was no organic matter cycling through the ecosystem. The paintings sat in a near-perfect preservation environment for more than 20,000 years.
The Altamira cave paintings in Spain are about 36,000 years old, and they're similarly well-preserved. The bison paintings on the ceiling are famous for a reason. The pigments are still rich. The reds are still red, the blacks are still black. And here's the key. Those pigments are iron oxides and manganese dioxides. Red ochre is hematite, Fe2O3. It's the same compound that gives Mars its red color.
Hematite is thermodynamically stable at Earth's surface conditions. That's the crucial phrase. It doesn't oxidize further because it's already fully oxidized. It doesn't react with water or atmospheric gases in any significant way. It just sits there, being red, essentially forever.
The black pigment in many cave paintings is manganese dioxide, MnO2, or charcoal. Charcoal is elemental carbon, which is also extremely stable. The binders the painters used, things like animal fat or plant resin, those decayed. But the pigment particles became mechanically embedded in the porous rock surface. The binder's job was to get the pigment onto the wall and hold it there long enough for capillary action to pull it into the microscopic pores of the limestone. Once that happened, the binder was redundant.
The pigment didn't survive because of a magic recipe. It survived because it got wedged into the rock's own pore structure.
And this is a misconception worth busting right now. There's this idea that ancient paints used secret recipes that we've lost. The reality is the pigments were simple iron oxides and manganese dioxides. The binders decayed. The pigment survived because it was mechanically embedded in porous rock, not because of some mystical binder chemistry.
Which means the surface was an active participant. The limestone wasn't a passive canvas. It grabbed the pigment particles and held them.
A smooth, non-porous surface like polished granite won't embed pigment the same way. The paint sits on top, forms a film, and eventually delaminates. Porous limestone or sandstone is a different story. The pigment migrates into the pore space and becomes, essentially, part of the rock.
The ideal ancient painting setup is a stable inorganic pigment, mechanically embedded in a porous substrate, in a cave with stable humidity and no UV. Hit all three, and you get 40,000 years.
If you miss one, you get nothing. There are almost certainly tens of thousands of ancient paintings that vanished within decades because they were on the wrong surface in the wrong environment. We only see the survivors.
Survivorship bias at geological scale.
The worst enemy of both carving and painting, by the way, is water in liquid form. For carvings, water enables freeze-thaw spalling and dissolves minerals along grain boundaries. For paintings, water dissolves any remaining binder, carries in microbes that eat organic components, and can physically wash pigment particles out of the pore space. If you can keep your mark dry, you've solved maybe 80% of the preservation problem.
UV is the other big one for paintings. UV photons have enough energy to break chemical bonds in organic pigments. That's why outdoor painted signs fade. The chromophores, the parts of the molecule that absorb visible light and produce color, get blasted apart photon by photon. Inorganic pigments like iron oxides are much less vulnerable because the color comes from d-orbital electron transitions in the iron atoms, not from delicate organic bonds.
That's why orange and red markers tend to outlast yellow and white outdoors. Iron oxide pigments are inherently more UV-stable than organic yellows and titanium dioxide whites.
We've established that carving is reliable but slow, and painting is fast but fragile, unless you get the environment exactly right. But what if you could combine the best of both? That's exactly what happened in 2009 with the invention of the M-Disc.
Let me walk through how the M-Disc actually works, because it's a brilliant piece of engineering. A standard writable DVD or Blu-ray uses an organic dye as the recording layer. The laser heats the dye, which changes its optical properties, and that's your data. The problem is that organic dyes degrade. Heat, humidity, and UV break them down over time. Standard DVD-Rs and accelerated aging tests typically run at 85 degrees Celsius and 85% relative humidity, fail after about 100 hours.
100 hours at those conditions extrapolates to what? A few decades at room temperature?
The dye layer oxidizes, the reflective layer corrodes, and your data becomes unreadable. The M-Disc takes a completely different approach. The recording layer is a proprietary blend of inorganic compounds, essentially a synthetic rock. When the laser writes to it, it doesn't change the chemistry of a dye. It physically melts and ablates the material, creating permanent pits in the layer. It's a physical engraving at the nanoscale.
A digital petroglyph.
The pits are physical features in a chemically inert substrate. They don't oxidize, they don't degrade under UV, and they're not affected by humidity. The U.S. Navy tested M-Discs at their China Lake facility, running the standard accelerated aging protocol. The discs survived 1,000 hours at 85 degrees Celsius and 85% relative humidity with no data loss. That extrapolates to a projected lifespan of about 1,000 years at room temperature.
1,000 hours simulating 1,000 years. That's a ratio of about 1 hour to 1 year.
The extrapolation isn't perfectly linear, but it's the standard model for accelerated aging in optical media. Standard DVD-Rs fail the same test after about 100 hours. The M-Disc lasts 10 times longer in accelerated conditions, and the failure mode for M-Discs isn't chemical degradation of the recording layer. It's eventual physical degradation of the polycarbonate substrate, the same plastic that standard discs use.
The weak link isn't the data layer anymore, it's the plastic it's embedded in.
And that's a solvable problem. If you encased an M-disc in a hermetically sealed container with an oxygen absorber, you'd extend the life even further by slowing the polycarbonate degradation. But at that point, you're designing for multi-millennial storage, and you have to start thinking about things like whether the container material will outgas corrosive compounds over centuries.
The truly obsessive archival thinking.
Which I deeply respect. But the practical point for listeners is that the M-Disc is the only consumer-available digital storage medium that has been independently tested to a 1,000-year projection. Standard hard drives have a shelf life of 5 to 10 years unpowered before the bearings seize or the magnetic domains decay. SSDs are worse. The charge stored in the NAND flash cells leaks over time, and an unpowered SSD can lose data in as little as a year or two, depending on temperature and how many write cycles the cells have endured.
Cloud storage depends on a company staying in business and maintaining multiple redundant data centers with active power and cooling. Your data is only as permanent as the corporate entity holding it.
Which for most cloud providers means, optimistically, decades. Not centuries, and certainly not millennia. If you want your grandchildren's grandchildren to be able to read your photos, the M-disk is currently the only practical option.
The ancient technique of physically altering a stable substrate turns out to be the best approach for digital data too. That's not a coincidence. It's the underlying physics of permanence asserting itself.
It really is. And let me contrast this with modern industrial markers, because we've talked about the Edding 780 and similar paint pens. Those use a xylene-based alkyd resin loaded with inorganic pigments. The paint forms a plastic film on the surface. That film is tough. It resists 400 degrees Celsius continuous exposure, it handles chemical splashes, it's abrasion resistant, but it's still an organic polymer. Over decades, UV and oxidation will embrittle it. The film will crack, lose adhesion, and eventually flake off.
Edding themselves only guarantee 10 years of outdoor legibility for the 780. 10 years versus 40,000 years.
That's not a criticism of the marker. 10 years in direct sun and rain is impressive for an applied coating, but it illustrates the fundamental limitation. Any organic binder will eventually fail. The ancient cave painters avoided this entirely because their binders were sacrificial. They held the pigment long enough for it to embed in the rock, then they decayed away, leaving the pigment mechanically locked in place.
The binder's job was to be temporary. That's the opposite of how we design modern paints.
Modern paint formulation is all about making the binder as durable as possible. Acrylics, alkyds, polyurethanes, epoxies. We're fighting a rearguard action against entropy, trying to make organic polymers that resist UV and oxidation. And we've gotten very good at it, but we're still talking decades, not millennia.
What about inorganic binders? Did any ancient culture figure that out?
Yes, and this is where it gets really interesting. Ancient Egyptian faience is a ceramic material made from silica, lime, and copper minerals. The copper gives it a brilliant blue-green color. The whole thing is fired, so the color is locked into a glassy matrix. It's essentially a synthetic stone. Faience beads and tiles have survived for over 5,000 years with essentially no degradation. The color isn't a coating. It's part of the material's molecular structure.
Egyptian blue is another one. The first synthetic pigment ever made.
Egyptian blue is calcium copper silicate, KCQC4010. It was invented around 3000 BCE. The Egyptians figured out how to make it by heating silica, lime, copper, and an alkali flux to about 850 degrees Celsius. The resulting compound is a crystalline blue pigment that is extraordinarily stable. It's been found on tomb paintings and artifacts that are still vividly blue after 4000 years.
It's not just stable. Egyptian blue has this weird property where it emits infrared light when illuminated with visible light. Conservators use this to identify Egyptian blue on artifacts, even when it's not visible to the naked eye.
The near-infrared luminescence. It's a unique spectral signature that makes Egyptian blue detectable even in trace amounts. And the fact that it survives in a detectable form after 4 millennia tells you everything you need to know about its chemical stability.
The Egyptians cracked the code, make the pigment itself a stable crystalline compound, then fire it into a ceramic matrix. No organic binder needed.
We're starting to see modern material science circle back to these approaches. There's research into silicate-based coatings that chemically bond to stone substrates. The idea is to create a paint where the binder is a potassium silicate solution that reacts with the calcium carbonate in limestone to form a calcium silicate bond. It's essentially a mineral. To mineral adhesion, no organic middleman.
Which is what the cave paintings achieved accidentally, through mechanical embedding, but done deliberately through chemistry.
And there's also quartz glass data storage, which is the next frontier beyond M-disc. Researchers at Southampton University have demonstrated femtosecond laser writing infused quartz. The laser creates nanoscale voids in the glass, encoding data in 3 dimensions. The resulting storage medium is stable at room temperature for, and I'm not exaggerating here, billions of years. Fused quartz is silicon dioxide. It's one of the most chemically inert materials on Earth. The data is a physical structure in the glass, not a magnetic domain or an electric charge.
We're back to carving in stone, just with a laser and a piece of glass instead of a chisel and a cliff face.
The most advanced data storage technology and the most ancient marking technique converge on the same principle. Physically alter a stable substrate. Everything else is a compromise.
Let me pull on a thread. The Nazca lines. They're subtractive, but they're also enormous. You can only see the figures from the air. Were they trying to make something permanent, or something for the gods to see?
The scale suggests they were meant to be seen from above, which in their cosmology meant by deities. But the technique they chose, removing dark surface stones to expose light subsoil, happens to be exceptionally durable in that environment. Whether they chose it for permanence or for contrast, they got both.
The contrast comes from the difference between the desert varnish on the surface stones and the unvarnished subsoil. The varnish itself is a slow accumulation of iron and manganese oxides, deposited by wind-blown dust and cemented by microbial action over thousands of years. By removing it, they created a mark that gets more visible over time, as the varnish on the surrounding surface continues to darken.
The mark actually improves with age. That's the opposite of almost every other marking technique, where the mark fades and the background stays the same. The Nazca lines are a negative image that gains contrast as the positive space darkens.
That's a design principle worth naming. If you want a mark to last, make the mechanism that preserves it the same mechanism that degrades its surroundings.
That's beautifully put, and it applies to carving in general. A carved inscription on a light-colored stone will accumulate dirt and lichen in the depressions, darkening the text against the lighter background. The weathering process that degrades the overall surface actually makes the inscription more legible, at least for a while.
Until the weathering goes too far and the whole surface falls off.
There's a window. For the Rosetta Stone, that window has been about 2,200 years and counting. For a sandstone inscription in a wet climate, it might be a few centuries.
Let's talk about what destroys ancient markings in more detail. You mentioned lichen growth on carvings. What's actually happening there?
Lichens are a symbiosis of fungi and algae or cyanobacteria. They secrete organic acids, primarily oxalic acid, that dissolve the minerals in the rock. The fungal hyphae physically penetrate into the pore space and along grain boundaries, mechanically wedging the rock apart at a microscopic scale. Over decades, lichen colonies can obliterate a carved surface.
There's no easy way to remove lichen without damaging the carving underneath.
Conservators struggle with this constantly. Mechanical removal with brushes and scalpels can abrade the surface. Chemical treatments can react with the rock. Laser cleaning is promising but expensive and not always practical for large sites. Sometimes, the best approach is to document the inscription thoroughly while it's still legible and accept that lichens are going to win eventually.
For someone today who wants to make a mark that lasts beyond their lifetime, what's the actionable guidance?
Choose a substrate that is itself stable, stone, ceramic, glass. Then physically alter it, engraving, etching, sandblasting, laser ablation. The mark should be a change in the substrate shape, not a coating applied to its surface.
If you must use paint,
use inorganic pigments in a silicate-based binder on a porous mineral substrate, or accept that your paint is temporary and plan to reapply it. There's no shame in a 10-year marking strategy if that's all you need. The problem is when people assume their paint is permanent and make decisions based on that assumption.
Like the permanent markers in every office supply closet that fade to ghostly purple after 6 months of indirect sunlight.
Those markers use dye-based inks. The dyes are organic molecules with chromophores that UV shreds. They're permanent in the sense that they won't wash off with water, but they're not light fast. It's a different definition of permanent.
The word permanent doing a lot of heavy lifting across multiple industries.
It always does. And that's why specifying the time scale and conditions matters. Permanent at 400 degrees Celsius is not the same as permanent in direct sunlight for a century. The Edding 780 is permanent in the first sense. The Chauvet cave paintings are permanent in the second.
What does this mean for you right now if you want to make a mark that lasts? Let's get practical.
First, if you need a mark to last beyond your lifetime, engrave it. A diamond-tipped scribe on a piece of stainless steel or titanium will produce a mark that will be legible for centuries in almost any terrestrial environment. For outdoor stone, use a carbide tip chisel or a sandblasting stencil. The key is to remove material, not to add it.
Second, if you're marking something that can't be carved, like a flexible surface, choose a paint with inorganic pigments and a binder appropriate for the substrate. Alkyd enamels with iron oxide pigments are a good starting point. But understand that you're buying decades, not centuries.
Third, for digital archival, the M-Disc is currently the only consumer medium that has been independently tested to a 1,000-year projection. Standard hard drives and SSDs have shelf lives of 5 to 10 years unpowered. Cloud storage depends on a company staying solvent. If you have family photos, important documents, or anything you want your descendants to have access to, burn them to an M-Disc and store the disc in a cool, dry place.
Label the disc. Ideally with an engraved label, not a stick-on paper one.
The irony of losing data because the adhesive on the label degraded and the disc became unidentifiable.
Fourth, the environment matters more than the technique. A mediocre carving in a dry cave will outlast a masterful inscription on an exposed hillside. If you're placing a memorial stone or a time capsule marker, choose the location first. Look for shelter from rain, drainage that prevents water pooling, and minimal freeze-thaw cycling.
Fifth, if you really want to think in geological timescales, look into fused quartz data storage. It's not consumer available yet, but the research is advancing. A five-dimensional data crystal, a disk of fused quartz with data encoded in three spatial dimensions plus intensity and polarization, can store 360 terabytes for billions of years. The technology exists. It's just not commoditized.
The Rosetta Stone of the 31st century might be a piece of glass.
Future archaeologists will puzzle over it the same way we puzzle over cuneiform tablets. What did these people consider worth preserving? What was so important that they wrote it into synthetic stone?
Which brings up a question that's been lurking under this whole discussion. What will future archaeologists think of our digital marks? If all our data is on SSDs that decay in decades, will the 21st century be a dark age for future historians?
This is a genuine concern among archivists and historians. We're producing more data than any civilization in history, but we're storing it on the most ephemeral media we've ever used. A clay tablet from ancient Sumer can still be read 5,000 years later. A hard drive from 2010 may already be unreadable, not because the drive failed, but because no one has a computer with the right interface and file system drivers.
The digital dark age. The idea that future historians will have better access to the administrative records of the Akkadian Empire than to the emails of the early 21st century.
It's not just a hardware problem. File formats become obsolete. Software that can read those formats stops being maintained. Encryption keys are lost. Cloud services shut down and take their data with them. A papyrus scroll in a dry Egyptian tomb is more accessible to a modern researcher than a word-perfect file on a 5.25-inch floppy disk.
We're simultaneously the most documented civilization in history, and the one most at risk of leaving no readable trace.
The solution, and this is where the ancient techniques become relevant again, is to write the important stuff into stable physical media. The M-Disc is one approach, microfilm is another. Properly processed and stored silver halide microfilm has a projected lifespan of 500 years, and you don't need a computer to read it. You need a magnifying glass and a light source.
Analog backup for digital data. The library world has been doing this for decades.
The problem is that it's slow, expensive, and nobody wants to pay for it. But the principle is sound. If you want it to last, put it on something that doesn't require electricity, proprietary software, or a specific operating system to read.
The ancient approach. Updated. Carve it in stone, or at least in something stone adjacent.
As we push toward exascale data storage, the pressure to solve the permanence problem is only going to increase. Data centers have a power budget and a physical footprint. You can't just keep adding hard drives forever. Long-term cold storage that doesn't require active power and cooling is going to become economically essential.
The most advanced data storage might look a lot like what humans were doing 40,000 years ago. Mark a stable substrate, store it in a dry place, and let physics do the rest.
The circle closes. And the oldest known figurative cave paintings, by the way, are at Leng Bulu Sipong 4 in Sulawesi, Indonesia, dated to at least 43,900 years ago. They're hand stencils and animal figures in red and mulberry pigments. The fact that they survived in a tropical environment, which is much more aggressive for preservation than a dry cave in France, is remarkable.
Tropical humidity, insects, microbial growth, everything is working against preservation in the tropics.
The pigment was iron oxide, the substrate was limestone, and the cave provided enough shelter to keep direct water flow off the paintings. The basic recipe, whether the painters knew it or not, was the same one that worked at Chauvet and Altamira.
The recipe is simple. The execution is hard. A stable inorganic pigment, mechanically embedded in a porous mineral substrate, protected from liquid water and UV. Nail those four variables, and your mark will outlast your civilization.
The fascinating thing is that ancient peoples figured this out empirically. They didn't have material science. They didn't know about d-orbital electron transitions or thermodynamic stability. But they knew, through generations of trial and error, that certain pigments on certain surfaces in certain places lasted longer than others, and they passed that knowledge down.
The original accelerated aging test. Make a mark, come back in 10 years, see if it's still there.
Iterated over tens of thousands of years, the surviving marks we study today are the successful experiments. The failed experiments crumbled to dust long ago.
Which is a humbling way to think about our own attempts at permanence. We're running the same experiment, just with better tools and a more detailed understanding of the chemistry.
We're still learning from what they figured out. The M-Disc is a direct intellectual descendant of ochre on limestone. The engineers at Millenniata looked at petroglyphs and cave paintings and asked, what's the underlying principle? And the answer was, physically alter a chemically stable substrate. Everything else is a coating that will eventually fail.
The next time you see a faded outdoor sign or a weathered industrial marker, ask yourself, would this have lasted longer if it were carved? The answer is almost always yes. But carving is slow and expensive. That's the trade-off we accept.
Speed versus permanence. It's the same trade-off the ancient Egyptians faced when they chose between painting a tomb wall and carving a stele. The paint was faster, but the carving lasted longer. They used both depending on the context.
That's the practical takeaway for anyone listening who's thinking about their own marking or archiving needs. Decide what timescale you're optimizing for, then choose the technique that matches. Use a good industrial paint pen. 1,000 years? 10,000 years? Engrave something and put it in a dry cave.
If you want to go full pharaoh, commission a granite obelisk.
The ultimate backup strategy.
I'm only half joking. The Washington Monument is an obelisk. It's carved from marble and granite. It has inscriptions on the interior and exterior. It's designed to be legible for centuries. And it doesn't require a software update.
All right, I think we've covered the sweep of this. Ancient carving, ancient painting, the chemistry of why ochre beats everything, the M-Disc as a digital petroglyph, and why your SSD is a worse archivist than a Babylonian clay tablet.
The open question that stays with me, what will future archaeologists think of us? Will they find our data, or will the 21st century be a gap in the historical record because we stored everything on spinning rust and flash memory?
If we want to leave a mark that lasts, we know how. The ancients showed us. The question is whether we care enough to do it.
That's the one.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1900s, whalers in the North Pacific reported that the songs of migrating humpback whales shifted noticeably when the whales passed through certain Mongolian shipping lanes. Biologists later determined the whales were incorporating rhythmic elements from the chants of Mongolian throat singers being broadcast from passing cargo vessels, creating a hybrid song that spread across multiple whale pods over the course of a decade.
Right. If you want to leave a review on your podcast platform, we'd appreciate it. It helps other curious minds find the show. And the question to sit with, if you had to preserve one thing for 10,000 years, what would it be, and what would you write it on? This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Thanks for listening.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host digging, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.